Guy Nelson Isaacs is a speaker that we have had here at the store before. He was actually only Sky Nelson at the time. Now he is Sky Nelson Isaacs, and we are delighted to have him return to talk about A Common Route for Science and Spirituality. He is, as I understand, about to return to graduate school in physics coming in August, so just a few weeks away. So we're glad to snag him before that deep and extensive commitment, as I know from my own experience. So please join me in welcoming Sky Nelson Isaacs.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you for the tea. This is such a lovely place to be and enjoy the energy, the tea and the books. Pleasure to be here. I am going back to graduate school. I'm going to San Francisco State, and you know, I began thinking about.
Oops, was that me?
No, that was time.
Fundamental reality.
Alright,
Stuart will agree with you.
You have a password though. Time unlocked.
Well, you could have told it all to us and told us to not expect it in, but then that fundamental would be different, wouldn't it? You'd have to change it.
Right. Yeah, the changing of time is like the changing of passwords. It has to happen every once in a while. So I became interested in spirituality at around the same time I became interested in science. In my teens, I started reading some books like the Tao Te Ching, and I had been exposed to some other Eastern traditions through my parents for many years. I read the Bhagavad Gita in my late teens, and at the same time, like in college, I started studying physics intensively. And you know, they tell you in physics, in the discipline itself, that physics is the fundamental science that describes all other sciences, and all other sciences can be reduced to physics in the end. So you can see why I would be that would be appealing to me when I was really interested in understanding was what is the fundamental nature of this reality that I'm experiencing. And that's probably why we're all here, is because we've had experiences that are mind-opening, soul-opening, that help us see the world in a bigger view, and we also see the world in a more dissected view every day. So we see both of those different perspectives, and we live between those two different poles in a dynamic balance. And we're interested in why and how does that balance work. If you ask a typical, you know, mainstream physicist, they'll tell you there's no balance. There's just the dissected materialist worldview. Everything is can be reduced down to little particles, and then those particles obey laws, the Newton's laws and the laws of thermodynamics. And in fact, well, I'll point out in a minute that your typical materialist will say that consciousness just happens to arise out of physics. Out of all those random molecules bouncing around, creating your brain over time, and then the way your brain happens to randomly work, somehow out of that arises this thing called consciousness, and we have it. And it's what's called an epiphenomenon. It's like a phenomenon that arises on top of something else that's more fundamental. And that more fundamental thing would be just basic material reality. And there's a lot of problems with that worldview, and I don't need to tell you about them, but that is the mainstream view if we consider mainstream science right now. There's a lot of evidence, however, and some of it's hard experimental evidence, but there's overwhelming amounts of personal evidence that consciousness may be more fundamental than the physical reality, and that consciousness may give birth to the physical reality. Physical reality happens inside of consciousness, sort of the opposite. Or even more along my line of thinking, that they co-arise together. That there's this gradual sort of maybe bootstrapping effect where they're both lifting each other out of nothingness into the physical world and the consciousness that supports the physical world. Now we know in quantum mechanics, and we've known for a long time, but the evidence just gets stronger and stronger, that particles and you and I, by extension, and all the objects in this room, by extension, don't have physical properties that are definite before an observation is made. And we know that for a fact. It's very well, it's accepted in the mainstream scientific community that particles don't have properties before a measurement is made. A measurement being something that we haven't quite well defined yet, but the interaction of a person or a consciousness or another object with the particle will actually give it its reality and its properties. And it doesn't actually have properties before that.
Is that like Schrodinger or Heisenberg or one of those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of those, yes. Or both of those.
Kind of, sort of.
Well, it is essentially the EPR, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, that which was solved sort of by Bell. And I'll go into that briefly a little bit later. But the experiment, and many experiments since then, show definitively that there are two particles, and they're, let's say, they're always opposite each other, because they're created together, kind of like twins. And so they, you know, they're always going to match. And they shoot apart from a common source. And I won't get into the details here, but depending on how you measure them, you get a certain type of result. And if you measure this one a certain way, it changes the way you get you measure this one, the types of results you get on this one, in such a way that it's completely clear mathematically that before everything happened, over here in the middle, when they were being generated, there was no actual property that we would call real. There was a potential for a property, but there was also the potential for other properties. And property maybe it would be spin in the case of a particle, or momentum, or in the case of, you know, extending this really far out into the everyday world, I like to talk about synchronicity. Synchronicity for me is the connection between what we can measure scientifically in the macroscopic world and the spiritual consciousness world. So I think synchronicity is like a key connection between between spirituality and science. And in those moments of synchronicity, when events line up just perfectly for you to have a meaningful experience, let's say you meet somebody at the store that you've been trying to run into for a long time, and the chances are really low, but you run it, there they are. You're in New York City, and there they are. Just before you did that, just before you walked in the door, their state was a potential. It wasn't an actual state. Just like these particles here had a potential property like spin, but not an actual property. And so when you actually run into that person, or when you actually make the measurement of the particles over here, I don't want to say you create the property, because you don't. It's not quite that. It's that you're pulling one of the possibilities out of the potentiality space, what I'm going to call the information realm. You're pulling a possibility out of the information realm into the actual world, and you're actually measuring that, just like when you walk in the store, you're actually measuring your friend sitting in that store in New York City at just that right moment. And so you've collapsed a world of potentialities into one actual experience.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that what you're describing, though, is a particular interpretation of quantum mechanics? I mean, there are other interpretations, like the Bohmian mechanics, that suggests that there's actually a reality underlying that isn't, and the mathematics gives us the probabilities of what we observe, but there's actually a distinct state that's actually happening underneath the surface.
It's a great question. And there's a couple parts to it. In terms of the Bohmian interpretation, that interpretation relied on something called hidden variables, which, as you said, is like quantum mechanics tells us the statistics of when we're going to measure something, but there's something underneath that that we can't even quite measure yet, which is telling it exactly how to behave. And so ultimately, it's not random. It's guided by something that we can't see. It's hidden. We call it a hidden variable. And the EPR experiment, which has now been validated by Alain Aspect in 1982 and then many others. In fact, more and more recently, they're coming like more exponentially fast, invalidates that result, that theory.
I'm not sure that that's the case. I don't think that Bohmian mechanics is invalidated by the EPR. It's just that there's a mathematically consistent alternative interpretation that suggests that there's the probabilities that we observe are that actual matter is guided by a pilot wave, which is determined by the wave function.
Yeah, I don't think that aspect is invalidated. The aspect that the APR experiment says very clearly that there can be no hidden variables.
Right.
And so we know for sure.
Well, it says that locality doesn't hold. You know, either you
local
have,
realism.
You don't have local realism. You have
right.
Kind of a global continuity. But I'm not sure that invalidates the formulation that Bohm has, because I think they're mathematically identical to.
Well, I don't think it invalidates the entire formulation. I think you're right, and I'd also like to hear more about the things that you're pointing to. But the EPR experiment, you know, your question was around, is it just an interpretation? And I want to point out very clearly that the Bell experiments showed mathematically and experimentally a distinction between the various interpretations of quantum mechanics. All the interpretations of quantum mechanics that rely on hidden variables, this particular way of looking at hidden variables in the theory, cannot be true experimentally. That's been shown to be false. And that's the beauty of that experiment. That's why it's so profound. And then the other piece I want to say is that out of the remaining many interpretations, there's really a distinction between relational interpretations and non-relational. I'm glad you're here, Julia. Where the difference is, a relational interpretation of quantum mechanics says that the state of a system is relative to you, the person that is observing it. Whereas the other interpretations would say the state of the system is objective. It just is, regardless of an observer being out there. And my main interest in sort of trying to move something forward in the physics world is to distinguish those two types of interpretations and show experimentally that only the relational experiment views actually hold up. And that would actually distinguish and get rid of some of the interpretations. So, but the bottom line is that almost all of the interpretations of quantum mechanics are interpretations that are sort of based on people's worldview. The fundamental data in quantum mechanics is the same, but you can interpret it different ways, and that's how we get the different interpretations of quantum mechanics.
Are you making a distinction between quantum mechanics and quantum physics?
No.
They're the same thing,
yeah. Quantum physics, quantum mechanics. There are other words too, but I know when you don't read about it a lot or you're not studying it, it feels like there's all these different words, they mean different things, but there's a very small number of different things we're talking about here that are all related with the same. So this is the questions I want to ask. Is consciousness a part of physics, or is physics a part of consciousness? Keep going there, Rob. We're going to scan through a few of them. So this one's important. So in my search for, you know, as a growing up young adult, trying to bring together the science that I was learning in school and the spirituality that I learned from my family and friends and my own experiences, I remember being in a lab course with my best friend in school, and I would ask him, we would have these discussions during our labs, our physics labs, we'd be, you know, studying light on the optics bench or something, and we'd talk about, I would say something like, well, why does that happen? And he would get really riled up and say, physics doesn't describe why things happen. Physics describes how things happen. And I felt strongly then, although I was a little quiet about it, but I feel strongly now that that's not really true. Physics needs to describe why things happen. There needs to be an element of meaning, essentially, is the way I describe it. That meaning is an important part of the reality we live in, and for a physicist to say that their theory of everything is a theory of everything, but not have it include meaning or any kind of the personal experience that we have, is sort of a travesty or an arrogance that I don't subscribe to. So I think that we need to include meaning, which maybe touches on things like love, and there's different ways to say it, but my word for it is meaning, in our description of reality, and therefore physics has to be able to do that, has to be able to incorporate that. So I'm just going to take one specific view tonight that, for me, wraps up my perspective on the connection between science and spirituality. And this is the statement here. I'm going to say, there is one unified entity in existence, the self, which perceives the world itself through localized perspectives, individually, separately, one at a time. That's the whole thing. So let's break it up a little bit into pieces. Can you go one forward? There's two parts here. The first one, there's one unified entity in existence. So that unified entity in existence, that is oneness, that's a unified view of the world, it's the Godhead that religions talk about. It's the cosmic consciousness that that Jung might have talked about. It's the perspective on the world that is oneness. And it's clearly not the whole thing, but that's a very fundamental perspective on the world, is the perspective of oneness. But that's not all. Number two is it perceives the world, or itself, through localized perspectives, individually, one at a time. So what I'm trying to get across here is that it is possible to see the world through a perspective of cosmic consciousness. But in order to actually have physical experience in the world, in order to have the laughter that you had over breakfast this morning, or the relationships with the people you have and the food you tasted for dinner, all of these specific experiences are part of the physical world. And in order to experience these specific life experiences, the cosmic consciousness needs to take form through us to do that. So cosmic consciousness is a great thing. Believe me, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying cosmic consciousness is bad. Cosmic consciousness is the oneness of all of us, but it can't experience the taste of a bagel or coffee. It can't experience what it's like to be tired in the morning when you wake up, and all of these things that come with specific life experiences. Cosmic consciousness needs to embody and come into the world through a person or a being or some kind of animal in order to experience actual physical reality. So what cosmic consciousness does experience is the sum total of all possibilities. But if you're connected to the sum total of all possibilities, that's oneness, but it lacks the ability to have a specific experience. And so, in some sense, God needs us just as much as we need God. God experiences itself through us, and we find wholeness by turning back to the silence or to God in order to gain that wholeness. So these are the two different aspects, which are like poles of reality or of existence in the way that I'm talking about it. Go ahead, Rob. Thank you. Are there any first of all, actually go back one if you would. Can you do that? Are there anything about this that doesn't sit right or doesn't make any sense?
Well, that fits very nicely. I just want to comment that your explanation of it led me into a dualistic experience, because we suddenly talked about God and us. Whereas when I read that, I don't experience dualism. So are you a dualist or a non-dualist? That's my question.
That question is kind of like the question, do you believe in God, to me, we're experiencing
you
God.
You believe in God, but it can be a non-dual experience. I don't believe in God. If I have a non-dual experience of it, there is no God in me. There's just...
Absolutely. And so we're saying the same thing, and I probably didn't connect it very well. I think the way maybe to frame it is that these are not separate things.
That's right.
These are different expressions of the same thing.
That's right. I would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I talk about, that's why I don't even like using the word God. I'm being a little more risky here, because I think we can all agree on the ambiguity of that word. And
because it makes it two when the premise is there's only one experiencing itself.
Right.
So I just want to see
exactly
where you're going.
Exactly. So when you look through the view of the cosmic consciousness, we are all the same individual thing, but when we look through our individual eyes, we appear to be separate, and that's the duality maybe, but it's delusion, right? It's samsara. So I don't consider myself a dualist or a non-dualist.
Okay.
Mostly because I don't think I completely understand what that term means. And by defining it, we suddenly become part of it and out of this oneness. So
be like asking you, do you believe in waves or do you believe in particles?
Right. It is. It's the way of particle duality. It's a duality of how are we perceiving or experiencing?
What question are we asking?
What question are we asking? These are all part of the same difficulty, and language doesn't help us really resolve it.
Language is the question.
Right. And you have to remember, we're all sitting here in space and time, which is this area here, localized perspectives, talking about this, trying to also connect to the oneness, but we're a little bit, hamstrung or handicapped, in that we're in space and time, and we're so familiar with space and time, and so used to that experience, that it's very difficult to consciously, you know, stay in balance between these. So we're talking about something outside of space and time from within space and time, and that's inherently hard. So I want to break these down a little bit and get a little more specific. I think it's possible to say, you know, this statement, there is one unified entity in existence, the self. Well, I'm going to say that same thing in terms of physics. This is the same statement. There's a non-physical realm of information. It's uniform in its information content. It is the foundation of all physical effects. So this cosmic consciousness we might think of as an information realm, a realm of information about reality. And that information is not just the one reality we're experiencing here, but it's all possible realities, all possible possibilities that could occur for us. All the quantum wave function superposition states are all part of the non-physical realm of information. And I want to, we're a little abstract now, so I'll go a little quickly through these slides, through a couple slides, and then we'll get more specific. So the next one would be, which perceives the world itself through localized perspectives. How does that localized perspective, how can we phrase that in physics terms? That's what I want to know. There's a thing called the single framework rule, which says that when constructing a meaningful description of the physical realm, it's necessary to restrict oneself to a single framework. This is true in the physics of quantum mechanics. In order to avoid paradoxes in your discussions around wave-particle duality, and whether it's a wave or a particle, you have to choose a particular question to ask, as you were saying, Stuart. You have to choose, am I asking about the wave nature or am I asking about the particle nature? I can't ask about both at the same time. And that's similar to the way in which we have to take single perspectives on the world and ask specific questions. Like I could ask Stuart, what's the state of the books on the shelf behind me? And he could answer that question. But I couldn't answer that question. From his framework, that question makes sense. From my framework, that question is undefined, because I don't have any information about that, those books behind me. Those are two different frameworks, and if we try to combine them into a single framework, it doesn't work, because we're two different individuals. And that's what the single framework rule is saying. You have to respect and appreciate that we're each in this world as individual frameworks, individual perspectives, absorbing information about reality.
So that means, though, that at any given time when you're constructing a description of a single framework, you never have the whole answer.
Right.
You never have the, quote, truth with a capital T by definition.
Right. That's right. So, the one thing you could say is that there's no bird's eye perspective of reality. There's your perspective that you're experiencing. But God's view, if I turn to this word one more time, and I know I'm going to regret it. God's view is not looking down on us and saying, oh, I see everything that you're doing, and you should have done X, Y, Z, but you really did A, B, C. God's view is seeing all the possibilities, and we're immersed in that, and we are that. And it's much more complex. There's no being out there that can see more than you of your life in that regard. So we're each limited in our worldview, and our reality is defined by what we experience and see and perceive in the way that I perceive it, that I see these principles working. So the single framework rule is very important. We have to respect that, and this comes back to relationality. The world is defined relative to us. So I want to tell you one application of this just so far that we're talking about. And I'm going to coming back to synchronicity. The idea that things can fall into place in certain ways that are meaningful. And this is important to me because this is the most practical application of, you know, these new ideas in our world, is how do I make more use out of coincidence in my life? I have a book that is in the process of being edited and will come out sometime in the next 6 months to a year, called What Are the Chances? Science, Serendipity, and Seizing the Moment. So it's the question I'm asking is, how do we make use of coincidences that happen in our lives that are meaningful? And how do they happen? Why and how do they happen? And much of this is in there. So I'm just going to make up an example. Let's say I was looking for a quote from the Tao Te Ching that I remembered, but I couldn't quite remember the words of it I wanted to share with you. Well, behind me is a realm of space that's undetermined relative to me, because I'm not observing it. I don't have information about it, and so it's unobserved. And unobserved in the world of quantum mechanics means it doesn't have definite properties yet. It's undetermined. So what's going on behind me is undetermined, so long as I don't turn around and look. Now, Stuart, he does have access to that information. All of you do. And one of you may see that there's a book that happened to have been set there, right on the counter, and it says the Tao Te Ching right there. And it happened to be set there by another individual when they were walking by to use the restroom or something. And that placement of that object would have been serendipitous to me. But the reason that's able to happen is because, from my perspective, it's unformed back here. And that whole reality back here is still available to fall into place in different ways from my perspective. Because from my perspective, it's unformed.
It's also serendipitous to you, but not to me. I wasn't looking for a book from Tao Te Ching, so seeing it there doesn't actually register in some ways, because it's not a framework I'm holding looking for Tao Te Ching.
Right.
So it's not only that it's serendipitous, but it's uniquely serendipitous.
Yeah. The meaning that it holds is unique to me in this particular case.
Right.
And I think that's true about synchronicity in general. And that's why meaning is such an important thing to bring into physics. Until we bring in an understanding of meaning into the world of physics, we're not going to be able to describe why these things happen. How many of you can say in the past year that you've had an experience that was meaningful and coincidental, that was unexpected, that made you kind of open your eyes and go, oh, that's funny. How did that happen in the past year? Okay, how about in the past month? The past week? Anybody think of one? So...
I'm going to be past 5 minutes. I'm going to text Ginny to ask her about our trip tomorrow. I didn't know she was coming tonight.
Oh.
And then I walked in the store and there she was.
Great.
So it was meaningful and serendipitous.
Perfect.
Yeah. That's exactly.
I had just been saying how we had sat in these two seats.
And you had sat in the
six
seats.
6 years ago.
So that's how you met.
Yeah.
That's great. I should have gone all the way down to, you know, the past 5 minutes, because that's what it's all about for me, is that it's a constant process that's always happening. If we're, and especially when we're open to looking for it, we'll see them more and more, those coincidences in our lives. I keep a running tally of stories. I'm not very good at remembering them until someone jogs my memory, but I try and keep the most current stories all the time, because I'm trying to convey that this is happening all the time. It's not like I had one big synchronicity once and I wrote a book about it. It's a constant process that we can learn to live with and live by in order to enrich our lives. And these principles really help me understand and illuminate how that's working. Let's go another slide forward and see what we have. So, I'll go ahead and explain what I mean by this slide. Let's take this object here. So, this object is approximately square-ish, and it's sitting on a table right there. Just like, this is a graph of that object. It's a square object, and there's a table, and then the object is represented by the fact that there's a bump there. Now, the information realm is represented by the Fourier transform. This is how far I've formulated to date. It's a Fourier transform of this object. So every object can be can have its Fourier transform taken and be displayed on a graph like these. Now, Fourier transform is an amazing mathematical process that we use to make MP3 files and do music and YouTube videos. It basically takes any shape whatsoever, or any sound wave form, or any video picture, and does a process on it and converts it into frequency information, into waves. It takes any shape and converts it into waves. And once that happens, you can then manipulate the waves, which are represented by frequency and phase. And so you can take a sound, like a music file of a jazz song, you can convert it into waves like this, and then you can cut off the high frequencies, or you can change the EQ by increasing middle frequencies and lowering low frequencies, all that stuff, and then convert it back into the space-time representation, and you get the same song, but with it's modified, it's been changed in those frequencies. It's beautiful, it's really amazing. And that process works in lots of different industries and process, physical processes, and I'm trying to apply it here in the sense that any object can have a physical, a Fourier representation. So this object here, this square, has a Fourier representation that looks like this. It's made of lots of low frequencies here, no frequencies at this level, some frequencies at this level, no frequencies here, and then some frequencies here. So it's got sort of a wave-like shape of its waves. Don't get confused by that. This is saying these are the frequencies of waves that are existing in this waveform here. If you put all of these, if you put a sinusoidal wave like that, for every one of these frequencies, the high frequency ones would be like that, low frequency ones would be like that, just like water waves, and you added up the waves from all of these contributions, you would get this object. It's beautiful and fundamentally amazing and mind-blowing as you understand that you can really decompose anything into waves. It's amazing. But the frequency is not the only important thing. The phase tells you how those waves line up. So phase, you know, you could think of it like time. We were talking about the fundamental nature of reality as time. You could think about time zones. Time zones, there are 24 time zones in the world, right? That's like one cycle of a wave. It's a day, from day to night, back to day. And I work for a software company right now, and we have folks we're working with in India. And if I want to get on the phone with one of them, I don't just pick up the phone and call them. I check what time it is, because I'm completely out of sync with them in terms of phase, right? Yeah. They're 12 and a half hours apart from me. So while I'm in the middle of a bump in the wave, they're in the middle of a trough in the wave. While I'm in the middle of day, they're in the middle of night. So there are only certain times of day when we're both awake. Those are the times of day when I can work with them. And that's like saying waves that are completely out of sync. And when you add up all these waves in the right organization, these waves in the right organization based on the phases here, that's when you get the object. Okay? Now, even cooler, go ahead and move forward one and watch this. Okay, I'm going to have you go back and forth a few times, Rob. When you move this top object, that's like moving it across the table like this, moving it in space. What do you see changing?
The phase.
Anybody can guess why the frequency doesn't change?
Frequency
is the shape of the object?
Yeah, like the high frequencies are the corners. Mm-hmm. And the very lowest frequency is the plateau.
Right. That's a good way to put it. And another way to say it is that the frequencies themselves represent the energy of the object. Mm-hmm. And energy is conserved in physics. That's a law of physics. So we know that just by moving the object across the table, it doesn't change its energy. It doesn't change its shape, as you were saying. So this never changes. But there's a one-to-one correspondence between the phase set up here and the position of the object. So what I'm trying to convey here is that this here is a perfect representation of this, just in another language, in another space. And that's why I call it the information realm. It tells us everything we need to know about this object, but in a mathematically abstract way. It doesn't include space and time. There's no space and there's no time in these two graphs. It's a timeless representation.
I don't get that there's no space, because I would have thought that the reason the phase changed is because it's now in a different location in space. Otherwise, why would the phase change if you just moved the object?
You're thinking about it correctly. You're just the word I'm saying is confusing you. When I say there's no space here, what I'm saying is this graph here is frequency, and this graph here is it's frequency versus frequency in two different directions. But the spatial moving this object doesn't move the phases that way. It completely changes the relationship of the phases. But I have. The phase determines where things are in physical space.
Right.
But there's no actual physical space in the phase. So this is an abstract space that isn't in space or time. And so these are part of an abstract space. The beauty of it is that this abstract space allows you to have all the things that you have in quantum mechanics, like superpositions of possibilities. You can have many different possible outcomes of an experiment represented in the Fourier, or in the Fourier representation. The information realm, without actually having a physical result yet. And so this mathematics can not only give you a representation of the world itself, but also all the other possibilities that could be true. So this is the much bigger view of reality that we're talking about, the unified view of reality, the information realm. So it's a lot of thoughts and ideas around this. Let's keep going a little bit further. So it's information about what? Possibilities. Keep going around. Thank you. It's information about possibilities. The information realm is telling us what are the possibilities that are available to us. And this is important to me because, especially coming back to synchronicity, that if we want to live with more synchronicity in our lives, what that means is somehow tapping in to this information realm where all those possibilities are represented. They're not here now, but they are possible. And by tapping in, if there's some way to tap into the information realm, we can have more likelihood of experiencing the possibilities that might be more meaningful to us. That's where I'm trying to go with this. Go on ahead. I just like this joke.
You are here.
Omnipresent possibilities. You are here and here and here and here. But one of the consequences of this timeless representation, this information realm, one of the consequences of the timelessness of the information realm is that it's equally accessible everywhere. It can't be that you over there have more access to this timeless information realm than I do. Because it's also spaceless. It's completely irrelevant where we are in space. And that's the beauty of that mathematical representation we were looking at a minute ago. This is all stuff I'm trying to get to. I can't say that anyone's proven this yet, but it's all part of a framework that we're trying to develop that, to me, makes a lot of sense. If I could explain this in practical terms for people in this room, it would be something like the experience of praying. Do any of you have an experience of praying, or it could be meditating, or that you know what I'm talking about? So I think we all take it for granted that it doesn't matter where you are when you pray. You could be at the bottom of a mine shaft, you could be at the top of a mountain, you could be in a church or a synagogue, you could be in the shower, you can be in your kitchen. Space and time are irrelevant because we have access to this information realm, or this omnipresent realm of possibilities. We have the same access no matter where we are. It's timeless and it's spaceless. So no matter if you're in outer space, do you think people in outer space can pray? Sure, space and time are irrelevant to this possibility space. So we can experience synchronicities even on a spaceship traveling to Mars. I think we all sort of take that, and it's obvious that there's no better place than there's no one place that's better than another to experience a meditative state, except busy street traffic might be a little hard. But So omnipresent implies uniform in some regard. This information realm must have we must have equal access to the information realm no matter where we are. That's telling us in some regard that we have complete access to all possibilities around the entire world right here. I mean, there's some way in which that makes the world feel very, very small. We're all tapped into the same omnipresent reality, no matter where we are. Yet, how is it that I can experience this right here, but I can't be in New York 5 minutes from now? Right? Clearly, not all possibilities are possible for me. Not all permutations can happen. There's some limitations to what can actually happen. And that's what's so interesting. That's the most interesting question. How is it that we can live in a realm of uncountable possibilities and yet be limited in what can actually happen in our lives? I know that I can be here, and then when I leave here, I have to walk out that door, and when I do that, I'm going to get in the car, and there's only a certain number of places I could drive. You know, we have a limited, normal life that has to be accounted for, even though there are uncountable possibilities. How does that interact? So the next thing I would say is, it's uniform in information content, but it's not uniform in information expression. So the content of all of reality is right here, right now. This is the whole thing. We have access to that. But we can't express every single possibility that ever existed right now in this room right here. And this is something, go ahead one slide. So it is true that the expression in the physical form is limited. I am not trying to say that we should be Pollyanna-ish and think that anything's possible. I definitely don't believe that. The expression into physical form of this possibility space is limited. There's only a certain number of things we can actually experience in any given moment. And it's sort of like this analogy of DNA. So we're talking about this concept of uniform in information content, not uniform in information expression. Well, DNA exists in our bodies, and every cell in our body has basically exactly the same DNA. And that doesn't mean that every cell in our body expresses the same reality. The cells in our brain express certain chemicals and hormones, and the cells in our bones are different, and the ones in our skin are different, and our liver certainly expresses different chemicals. So it uses the information content, which may be uniform, but each cell uses the information content in different ways. So it expresses it in different ways. In the same way, you and I have access to the same genetics of the universe. It's all right here, right now. But we can only express what's relevant to this particular phase arrangement in that information space. The one that tells us that I'm standing right here and you're sitting there right now at this moment in time. So in short, I'm just trying to say we are limited by the obvious physical reality that we are in, and yet from here we can begin to open up to many, many possibilities that we might not otherwise think are possible. When I walk out that door, the farther I get into the future, the more open are the possibilities and the less they are constrained by me standing here right now. So I want us to stay grounded in the idea that we are here and now, as Ram Dass would say, be here now.
That's right.
And yet, don't get deluded, as I think that was your word, don't get deluded by that's the entire thing, because as we walk out that door, the possibilities begin to open up. As we take any kind of step into the unknown, the possibilities open up as to what could possibly happen that would be meaningful to us. So I'll pause there for a minute. Is it maybe a good time for a song and then a break?
Song, yeah.
Song?
Okay.
Do you take requests?
What's your request?
I don't have one. I'm just curious.
I like this.
Only if they're vocalized.
This is a local song written by me locally. What were we saying? Local realism. know if this is real or not, but this is a song about that same dynamic of being grounded, but also being open to the possibilities that can lead off from this point in space and time. It's about how when we transform ourselves into something new, it's still us. We don't lose the skin of our bodies, we don't lose the personality, we're still ourselves, and yet we can transform into something even bigger. The simple things that live inside me, I've found an open door, and I finally recognize the three rides to come. And the knowing that it's always known, now easy to my lips, can pass me quickly by without seeing all I've done and all the many blessings I've begun. And the people that I've brushed my heart upon just going through their day, I have helped them find a state of grace. I am more than I ever thought I'd be. Welcoming new, welcoming new. I am the change I always hoped to see. Welcoming new. Welcoming, welcoming. So, if you would, Rob, thank you for singing, by the way.
Thank you for singing.
I have a CD available in the back. Oh, it has that song and a number of others. Are you familiar with Marianne Williamson?
Mm-hmm.
There's a song on there called There Is Nothing Big in Playing Small, which is the lyrics from her poem, A Return to Love, which is her most famous poem that I put to music.
Wow.
It's it's a fairly moving song. It's very moving to me. So anyway, it's available. I think usually $15 back there. The donation jar, if you'd like to pick one up, you can. So talking about the information realm, we said phase determines the unique expression of possibilities. So we can go forward from there. Why do I suspect it's important, the information realm and all this discussion, mathematically? I want to turn briefly to the Bell EPR experiments we talked about earlier. Einstein didn't like this part of the theory because he pointed out that if you take two particles, if you start them off so they're in an entangled state, and then you send them far a long distance apart, and you decide way over here how you're going to measure it, that actually determines what kind of measurement you can do over here instantaneously. And Einstein invented the theory of special relativity, which says that information always travels at the speed of light, not instantaneously. So this appears to be, although it's actually not, but at first glance it appears to be in direct conflict with special relativity, and so that he called it spooky action at a distance.
Who called it spooky action?
Albert Einstein. Oh. It turns out you can't actually, at least as far as we can tell, convey information through this type of apparatus. There is an instantaneous correlation between particles that travel in that direction and particles that travel in this direction. But you can't send messages with them. If you look at the mathematics, it shows that you cannot actually send any information instantaneously across the universe. And so there's no actual conflict with special relativity. Yet, there is an instantaneous correlation between particles. Let me explain why this experiment is so interesting and mind-blowing. Imagine you took two pennies and two empty shoe boxes. And you took your two pennies and they were both
heads.
And you look at them, they're both heads, you put them each in one of those boxes and you set them down and you don't touch the boxes. You cover them up so you can't see. Now you know each box has a coin that's heads. Now you very carefully transport one of those boxes with you to New York, and you take the other box and you take it with you to California, and or say Japan, it's across the world. And you now have two boxes that are separated very, very far apart. And if you look in one box in New York, what are you going to see?
Heads.
If you look in the box in Japan, what are you going to see?
Heads.
Okay, they're correlated, right? Nothing unusual there. That's what we call correlation. If you know one, then you know the other. Now, in the experiment, what they do, they take the box in New York and they shake it. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, they make their measurement. If you look in the box here, what do you expect to find?
Heads or tails.
50-50 chance, right? Mm-hmm. Completely randomized chance of 50-50. If you open the box in Japan, what do you expect to find?
It
didn't get shaken.
So it should be.
You should find heads. That's the classical world that we live in. But in this experiment, what happened, not with pennies, with electrons and stuff like that, different particles. But in this analogy, it's like we shake the box in New York, and whatever turns up there is what we find when we open the box in Japan. Is that not bizarre? That's the exact analogy for this experiment. So somehow the shaking of the box in New York affected the outcomes that you get in Japan. If the box in New York still ends up being heads, Japan still get heads. You wouldn't say that's weird because it was heads to begin with. But if it turns up tails in New York, you open the box in Japan, you're going to find tails. Then you're stumped. How did that connection happen?
But it seems the ancient world was really aware of this, and the whole practice of divination is based on this idea of microcosm and macrocosm constantly interacting.
I completely agree with that. And to me, the beauty of of Jung's book, An Acausal Connecting Principle, and also the book by David Peet, on synchronicity, both talk a lot about divination tools. Can I tell you how I think? You're familiar with runes?
Mm-hmm.
The divination tool of runes? I've used runes for 20
years.
This is the one I'm more familiar with because I use it. But I'll give you my brief theory on how I imagine that working with synchronicity, because I've been thinking about synchronicity from this sort of trying to be rigorous about it and wondering, how is it possible that I can also believe in runes unless there's a theory of it? I want to have a theory. So here's how I envision it happening. You have a bag full of little stones. Each one has a different symbol on it, and each of those symbols means something in the Nordic language. And then you have a book that has a translation of each of those symbols into something a little more practical for you. You know, like, this rune means you need to take some space and be quiet for a while. This rune means it's time to take action and, you know, take a risk or something. So you've got the interpretation in the book, and then you've got a bag full of runes that's all randomized. And you shake the bag, and then you reach in the bag. At what point is the specific rune chosen that you're pulling? At what point is that rune chosen? I mean, if I grab one and I decide to let that go and pick a different one, or if I, let's say I reach in the rune, I grab a bag, and then I think about my question, does that affect what rune is in my hand? Because I thought about the question after I pulled the rune. These are all the questions that I've pondered as I'm doing this. And divination to me does relate to the principle of synchronicity, in that, in this case, the rune I picked up isn't even determined, because I haven't looked at it. I have no information about it. It's still in the bag. Just because it's in my hand doesn't mean the markings on it are definite or in form.
From your perspective.
From my perspective. And this is a key point. It's what I call retroactive event determination. Retroactive event determination is saying that the reality of which rune is actually inscribed on the one in my fingers is retroactively determined when I actually look at the rune. And so I can grab the rune, I can then ask the question, and then I can look at the rune and have it be a meaningful reflection of that question. Because it wasn't actually determined until I looked at it, even after I picked it up with my fingers, which rune it was. So I'm trying to apply this idea of, things are not in form until we actually interact with them, until we actually look at them and gain information. And that can allow for meaningful coincidences, which in my mind allows a lot of these tools to really be functional, and the whole history of divination.
I wonder if you need to have synchronicity happen in that way, that end, because my own experiential explanation is whatever it is I picked up could have been determined. It isn't waiting to be determined when I look at it. What makes the meaning is that when I then contemplate or look in the book or read what the meaning is, I create the synchronicity by reading that meaning in relationship to the question I'm holding.
Yeah.
So it's not because the physical ruin has been suddenly determined, but because my consciousness now pre-selects meaning out of the ruin. I'm just putting the synchronicity at the other end, not at the time that you pick it.
Interesting.
But at the time that you read it and a recognition takes place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think ultimately it'll be experimentally verifiable whether there's a physical process of retroactive determination or not. And that's my hope, is that I'm never going to be able to have this conversation with a mainstream physicist unless I can say, here's the experiment, and here's how it will determine one way or the other, and then we can both learn from it.
Yeah. I guess because in my mind, it's not necessary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To understand the synchronicity of the ancient divination tools, retroactive determination is not necessary.
So the question I would ask on that appears in my mind is, a lot of the times I pick a rune and it's somewhat relevant, and then sometimes I pick a rune and it's relevant enough, it's so relevant that it makes me really amazed, like, this is really working, because there's always a seed in me that's saying this isn't working at all anyway, and I pull the rune and then it matches and I go, well, wow, it really did work.
Yeah, but I hold that's your consciousness recognizing the meaning.
Right. Yes.
I'm not just...
No, it's well put. So So, but I do feel like.
But then that becomes dualistic if you go too far with that.
What? In what way?
Well, because, I mean, you have to look at the larger context too. You can't just isolate this event from anything else. You know, there's also why are you doing that at that particular moment in time, right? And so I think there's definitely room for, yes, I think what you're saying is true. I think that there is an aspect of consciousness that creates meaning, or that makes thread meaning, or weaves meaning between symbols and thoughts and ideas and emotions and all that kind of thing. But at the same time, that's also interacting with physical reality. And so the room is acting like a channel, if you will, between two levels of reality. That's how I see it.
Yeah. And I think that one of the key points that I think you pointed to there is there a way in which the physical world is responding to what's going on inside of us? Mm-hmm. Is there a relationship between the inner and the outer worlds? And that's what I think the divinity that its cultures have known for generations, for millennia.
Yeah, that's the micro macrocosm.
Yeah, the micro macrocosm principle. And the amazing thing, this is what gets me out of bed every morning, is that we live in a time in history when we can actually verify what people have known for millennia with a whole nother level of knowledge, practical knowledge, the application of the scientific method. And I mean, that's why it's such a travesty that mainstream science is so fixated on its limited view of things, because what we're able to possibly achieve in this time in history is so amazing, to bring together traditional wisdom with the science that we've developed. I think we can do it. That's the most exciting thing in the world today, I think.
Can I ask you a little off-topic question here?
I may or may not answer it, but yes, you can.
Do you believe that there's such a thing as something like remote viewing, where someone actually sees something that's, you know, in space and time, either in space and time currently, or it could be in the future projected, they can see something?
I think the most important stance to take is not knowing. And this is a very Buddhist perspective. I've seen lots of evidence that that's possible, because I've seen people like Elizabeth Rauscher speak, and another gentleman at the, I'm forgetting his name. I go to the Society for Scientific Exploration Conference, and there's a fair amount, this is where folks that are in that field come and speak and present their papers. There's a lot of evidence for it, so it sure seems like these people know what they're talking about. And I don't know enough about it to say yes or no, so I would just, I come at it with an open mind.
But it's fair to say that there are a body of double-blind experiments that show a high statistical likelihood that there's a remote viewing effect, without explaining what or why or anything about that, but simply demonstrating the likelihood that there's some remote viewing capability.
Yeah, yeah. Yes,
Michael. I love the idea of future cause. That there is an event that cannot be avoided, it's going to happen. And that the event is itself the architect of circumstances leading to itself, kind of like a birth. Like, this child is going to be born, that is going to happen. And it is calling events and circumstances together to facilitate it's happening.
Yeah.
Actually, that's my experience.
Mm-hmm. So can I comment on that? Yeah. So that's been my experience as well, and trying to understand how that works, when it's clearly, I've also found that it's clearly not that there's, I'm not fated necessarily to have a specific experience, because there's times when it seems like I should be destined to have that experience, and yet it doesn't happen. But there does seem to be a way in which I end up having exactly the experience I need to happen. So the way I envision what you're talking about is that there is a vast arrangement of future possibilities, a countless, infinite arrangement of future possibilities, and that exists in the information realm. It's one of the, it's many, so if it's a very important or probable event, it's probably got many different representations in the information realm. There's many ways in which that event could happen. And yet I think it's really important, at least in my experience, to realize that there's also ways in which that event may not happen. And so it may be a strong event that's there's a lot of pathways that lead to it, and so in a sense it's architecting our way to it. And yet it's still up to us to maintain our sense of agency to work towards whatever it is that we envision, because it can't do it without us. So that's kind of the way I look at it. But it is out there in that future possibility space. Did you want to say anything else on that, Michael? Or we can just sit there.
Oh,
with it.
There is an unavoidableness.
Mm-hmm.
There is an unavoidableness, and it's for me. It has to do with not believing in possibility at all. I don't believe in possibility. Not believing in possibilities makes things very interesting for me, because it means that I believe the art of the universe is to create the moment, and the moment is the work of art.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for the moment, and the moment's occurrence, the moment's existence requires a collaboration of everything. Absolutely everything. So that collaboration is so intimate and so wonderful and so beyond anything that can be conceived.
Yeah.
Mentally, so it blows my conceptual brain.
Yeah.
I just throw it away.
Yeah.
And enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
There's no choices involved. It's just a moment creating itself.
No choices.
And I think we're in alignment there. You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a way
yeah.
of the vertical.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Do you have a comment?
Yeah. I agree. There's something weird going on in this universe. There's more than physics happening, but I'm not sure how this relates to it. In quantum mechanics, all kinds of weird stuff can happen. Statistically, it's fairly likely, like tunneling, for instance. You know, these things, but they can't happen on statistically, they're extremely unlikely to happen on a macro scale. Like, you know, a pink elephant could appear in this room all of a sudden. From quantum physics perspective, yes, but it's less than one in a Google chance that it could happen. And the same thing, I think, when you're talking entangled particles. At a single particle level, yes, it definitely happens. But it's like statistically extremely unlikely when you get to the size of a penny. So I'm not sure how this really explains, you know, how entanglement can really be taken to a macro scale.
So that's a perfect question. I really appreciate you brought that up. This is the number one important point that I have to contend with in the paper, in the book that I wrote, and the papers that I write, because this is the way people think about quantum mechanics is based on a principle that's been well established called decoherence. And what you're describing is decoherence. That if you have two particles that are minuscule, they can have quantum effects. But the minute you bring a trillion of them together, or a mole of them together, say, to make a gram of material or whatever it is, the thermal heat that's involved with those particles creates enough noise to wash out any of that, what we call coherence, or that alignment of phases. And so it's like imagine I had 1,000 tape decks all playing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, but I had 1,000 monkeys just all hit play at whatever time they wanted to, so they're all playing at different times. The music is completely lost. I have 1,000 different versions of the same thing, but they're out of sync, and it's just a bunch of noise, white noise. That's what you're describing as like a penny, is a combination of trillions of atoms that are all, according to the decoherence theory, out of sync with each other and washing out that quantum interference, that quantum behavior. So starting from that point, let me explain what I would say to a quantum physicist who okay. made that point to me. I need to figure out how to change the time on that. So there's two important points. One of them is that perspective is premised on the perspective that there's an absolute reality. In other words, if this atom interacts with what they call, in the paper originally by Zurich, who, you know, on decoherence, he says, you take a particle and it interacts with the environment, quote unquote, the environment. The physicists love the environment. They talk about the environment all the time. You know, there's an environment which contributes heat to the process, and there's an environment which has entropy in it. And then you got this poor little particle interacting with this huge environment, and it just absorbs all the quantum effects. The problem is that if you take a relational view, which is the view that the state of one object is only relative to another object, the whole concept of the environment goes away in a sense. So, for instance, you know, the way I describe it in the book is like this: if you're sitting in your car, sitting still on a very, very foggy morning, you'll see little droplets appear on your windshield, and each of those droplets is a quantum particle that has quantum properties, and it's interfering with the other quantum particles, and those particles will slowly collapse with the other ones near them. A mainstream quantum physicist would say, well, it's collapsed, now it's definite in some kind of absolute sense. Now that there's a certain number of them there, it's got a definite state. But the math and the experiments do not show that to be true. That's taking an absolutist view. The relational view says that this particle of fog now is in relationship with all these other particles, and they form a bubble together. And there's still a quantum system displaying quantum interference with each other. Relative to each other, however, with the rest of the particles on the windshield, relative to each other, they're definite. There's a correlation between the particles within the droplet. So in other words, this particle on this side of the droplet is definitely tied to the particle on the other side of the droplet. There's no more interference there. But as a whole, they're a quantum unit that displays the same interference. There's nothing that's made that interference go away, because there's no absolute environment. The only absolute environment in this analogy is the edge of the windshield. When anything touches the edge of the windshield, it really does collapse into a definite state relative to the car, and you could call that objective reality, right? Is this analogy making some sense? The problem is, in the relational model, there's no edge of the windshield at all. It's just relations between objects. So the particles in the penny are all in a definite state relative to each other. They're decohered, as the decoherence theory says, relative to each other. There's no interference. If you find this particle on this side of the penny, you know that the other particle is like a centimeter away. There's a complete correlation relationship. But this penny relative to this penny, there's no correlation whatsoever. And so, there's actually no mathematical reason why the interference that happens at a quantum scale goes away at some other scale, as long as you follow the rules of keeping, you know, the relationships separated.
So I have a question about that.
I appreciate that question, because it's a tough one.
So that suggests whereas the aspect experiment has been established with photons that are prepared in particles of light that are prepared in a particular match state. What you're saying suggests that you could do the same experiment with pennies. Has there been an experiment?
No, that's not true. So I haven't explained it well enough, because that's not actually true. You can't So let me say it a little bit further. You can't do the same type of experiment with pennies because they don't have the same
particle behavior.
Spin.
They don't behave like particles.
Well, the way you're describing it, if they're coherent with respect to each other, but with respect to two different pennies, that they're essentially not definite, then that seems to be like they are being described as waves.
Yes,
and
but
you should be able to do a.
But you can't do that particular experiment, or any of those other spin experiments, are based on a particular property that obeys the uncertainty principle. So the penny doesn't have a particular property like spin that obeys the uncertainty principle, whereas the atoms that make up the pennies, each of them do. But those alignments of those spins are canceling out, as you were saying. What's your name, sir?
Alan.
As Alan was saying, the alignment of all those spins is randomly canceling out. And so the property of spin loses its relevance to the penny. The penny doesn't have any spin to measure.
That leads me to the question of why this whole relationship between particle physics and reality. What is it that's making a penny, which is made out of particles, what makes those particles lose their behavior when they become so close that they become a penny?
What behavior do they lose?
Spin, for example.
Well, they still have spin, it's just all the particles have different random orientations, and so it cancels. They cancel out. They still have spin.
But you're saying, I'm just trying to understand, because you're saying in the what you were describing, that the penny isn't in a definite heads or tails state.
Right.
I mean, that's a framework that I can apply to a penny.
Right.
So if it's not, if I have two pennies and they're not in definite heads and tails states, are you saying that I can't do an equivalent of a Bell experiment?
This is actually helping me a lot, because you've helped me clarify what I'm trying to convey. You can't do the exact same experiment. First of all, the spin doesn't have any relevance for the pennies, so there's no that property you can't measure on a penny, or you know, there's no other obvious correlation, you know, or analog to the individual particle state. But here is the core of what I'm interested in my work, is that I think synchronicity is that experiment. Synchronicity is the experiment of having two entities that are correlated, and everything is correlated. We all come from the same source. Having entities that are correlated matching in unexpected ways. And that's exactly what happens in the two-particle experiment. You've got a correlation between whatever you measure here happens to match what you measure here. And that's the same thing that's happening in a synchronicity, where your experience of the situation, or how should I say it, your position in space and time matches someone else's position in space and time in a meaningful and unlikely and correlated way. So my view is that synchronicity is exactly that experiment, but you have to translate it a little bit. If you can't measure spin, you have to measure meaning.
So if I translate that, just to follow what you're trying to say, is that in the example of the particle experiment, there's a correlation that's set up, and then the particles are allowed to move separately. So are you suggesting that in a situation of synchronicity, there's some sort of intrinsic or interior correlation, and that we may be macroscopically expressed and separated in space and time and circumstances, but that when you have a moment of observation, that there will be a consistency or a correlation that you recognize, and that the meaningfulness is a recognition of a prior correlation of yourself and whatever the state of affairs is that you're observing.
That's really well put, yeah. Yeah. That's essentially the way I view it.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it leads to the idea that everything is correlated. We all came from the Big Bang. There's no ultimate separation between all the particles. That doesn't mean that you and I have ever met before, but there's some way in which...
if there's one self, we probably have.
Yeah. That's pretty much what we're saying here, is that there's an information realm that we're all... Or there's a self, a capital S self, that we're all part of. So I think correlation in the case of particles, the way we measure it is usually from an original event, like a calcium ion getting excited and giving off two photons or something. In the case of us in synchronicity, it's not that clear cut. We may have a synchronicity with someone we've never met before. So we have to really think about how am I correlated with events that I've never met before. There must be something fundamentally connected about our space and time, and that's what I'm trying to get at with this information realm, this timelessness representation.
Well, I guess the question I have with your explanation is whether the meaning of the correlation exists a priori, or if the meaning is an expression of a sort of novel recognition of the fact that we're always in every way correlated, but if I have a moment of synchronicity, I'm sort of imposing a particular framework in that moment, and it's novelty, and there's meaning in that, but it, in one sense, it's not any more meaningful than anything else, except for the fact that I experience it as meaningful.
Well, as we were saying earlier, that the meaning is relative, in my view, relative to the individual. So the Tao Te Ching on the table here will be relative to me, it will be meaningful, but to you it may not be. So I think that I think we have to describe, we have to explain that somehow. I think that meaning is a result of action. In fact, you know, physicists don't like the word meaning anyway, so I describe it as correlation. There's a correlation between the actions I take and the type of experiences I achieve as a result. And that's the correlation I think we should be able to show. And that's what synchronicity is. It's like I take a certain set of steps to bring something into my life, and then a synchronicity happens that somehow makes that real in a way that I didn't expect. And the measurements that I'm making through my actions is bringing about a certain set of outcomes from this undetermined realm out there.
I tend to agree with the perspective that you're describing, but one of the common critiques of this perspective is that the way human consciousness is configured, we have this thing called confirmation bias, so that there's a zillion things that happen that are uncorrelated that I don't pay any attention to.
Right.
But the one thing that happens where the Tao Te Ching is on the table, because I've been thinking about the Tao Te Ching, all of a sudden I relevate my consciousness and turn that into a significant event.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a valid critique, and it's an interesting one to deal with, because it may be synchronicity may be a function of the way our consciousnesses impose meaning on events, and there's a myriad of undifferentiated events until the one that comes along that actually has correlation. But if you actually do a statistical analysis of events and probabilities and coincidences, some critics say that you actually show that coincidences aren't really distinguished.
And so I think it's important to identify that there are some. It is always a measure. There's always doubt for me. There's always doubt. Like, is this really possible? And even I mean, to me, that there's two ways to prove synchronicity. Either you have an event that's so improbable that you can show it, and I think I have at least one of those. And in my book, I actually calculate the probability of this event, and I show through statistical analysis that it's within statistical experimental error. It would be unreasonable to try and explain this as chance.
What's your p-value?
5%.
0.05.
Yeah. So I mean, with the most generous circumstances in the critic's favor, I come up with a 5% p-value. And that was really what I was aiming to get, you know, so it's a biased analysis, but it's very clear that I've basically given them the argument and then said, look, it still doesn't hold up. And I'll tell you that story in just a minute, because it's a fun story. And then you could have like one really amazing experience, or you could have lots of experiences every single day that continue to just push the edge of likelihood, and then you could show from that there's a bias towards synchronistic meaningful experiences. And I think both can be done, especially experimentally, the second type, you know, if you can show that. And there's been experiments that have sort of gone in that direction. Would you like to hear the story of the synchronicity? How many of you have I told this story to you? It's about meeting someone in a special place in Europe. No, I'll just tell it. So when I was 20, I was in college, and I took a semester off from studying at Berkeley. And you know, I was a little bit tired. And I wanted to go backpacking in Europe. So I got a ticket for Europe, and I had this friend that I had been really close with in high school, and we had fallen out of touch through college, and we had been best friends. And we got back in touch just before this trip. And it turns out she was going to go live on a kibbutz in Israel for the same semester that I was traveling, just backpacking around Europe. And so we made this plan that was so vague, it was basically this: let's meet on a beach in Greece. And that was the extent of our plan. But we were serious about it. We wanted to make it happen. And we planned to call each other from the road and or whatever. We didn't have email at that point, really, and there were no cell phones. This was in 95, I think. And so about 2 months into my trip, I am traveling through Spain, and we hadn't talked yet, and I finally give her a call from a payphone at the hostel that I was staying at, and we chat for a few minutes, catching up, and we're about to start making a plan for this Greece adventure, and then suddenly I look at the bill, and it's $30.
Oh, no.
And, I mean, I didn't have $30 to pay, or I had about that, so I was like, I gotta get off the phone, I'll talk to you soon, I'll call you when I'm closer. Bye. So we didn't have a plan, and I'm traveling further, and I get to Rome, and I end up getting sick, and I realize I have to cut my trip short and head home. So, of course, the plan in Greece is not going to happen. I'm just going to go catch my flight from Paris, which is where my ticket was from. I just have to change the date of flight and catch it home, and I'll call her when I get home in 3 days. So I get on the train to go from Rome to Paris, and meanwhile, she's in Israel, telling all her friends about this guy, Sky, that she's going to meet in Greece, and they've begun to think that she's a little nutty and that I don't exist because I haven't called or emailed or anything. And but she's devoted and committed to waiting for my call. And one weekend they say, you know, we're going to go to Paris for the weekend, and you want to come with us? We're just going to go get a flight down there, do the, I think it's Fashion Week, and you know, explore the sights. And it's a quick trip from Israel. So guess what she said? She said, no, I'm going to sit here and wait for Sky to call. Because if he doesn't call, or if he calls while I'm gone, we'll never meet on the beach. She was a very devoted friend. Well, luckily, she gets on the phone with her mom that night, and her mom basically begs her and says, honey, forget about Sky. Just go to Paris and have fun while you're there. It's like a chance of a lifetime. So she listens to her mom, and she gets on the plane and goes to Paris. So, of course, that's the first question is, okay, I'm in Paris, so what? What's the chances of actually meeting someone else that I know in Paris? And then I go into, you know, I calculate that likelihood of all the people I knew that were traveling, and what's the likelihood that one of them would be in Paris. Paris is the population of such and such. It's one of the top 20 traveled cities in the world, so that gives a certain statistical likelihood to that choice. And then we happen to both decide to go to the Louvre Museum, which is the biggest museum in the world. It's also one of the biggest tourist attraction there, so it's fairly likely that she would go. But I'm walking through the Louvre. I've been there about 3 hours. I just had lunch, and I walk down this hall, and I walk into a room, and I stand there staring really awkwardly because there's this woman standing there that looks exactly like my friend Dana. And I'm scratching my head and just staring. And, of course, I remember I was sick. So I've been traveling for 2 months. I had a dirty green jacket. I had a hat on, I think, you know, like a beanie cap to keep me warm. It was cold out. I'd been sick, and I had gloves on. And so there's this really strange guy staring across the Louvre Museum at Dana, and her friend says, Dana, don't look now, but there's this really weird guy staring at you. So bless her heart, she looks over and she says, Carrie, that's Sky. She points me out, we connect, and strangely, she brought this journal that she wrote for me while we had been apart. And I don't know why she brought it to Paris, but she had it with her, and she gave it to me, and we spent the whole night in the airport waiting for my flight and catching up. And there's some other events that happened in the next 5 or 10 years, but eventually we got married, and now we have a kid. That's my wife. So even if you calculate the likelihood of some acquaintance of mine being in the Louvre at that point in time that I had intended to meet in the beach in Greece, that's an important part of the equation, right? It's not just some other friend that I randomly met walking around the Louvre Museum. It's a person I intended to meet in Europe. The intention part, I think, is important. plus, I truly consider her a soulmate. I mean, we were best friends in high school. We ended up disconnecting and then becoming marriage partners and parents together. So this is a particular person that was very important. And whenever I question whether this little synchronicity was really meaningful, I go back to that, and I think I can show that there's got to be something.
I think you should be studying magnetism instead of physics. Because the magnetism of people's energy is what attracts and causes synchronicity. I'd like you to expand your studies when you go to school, please.
To include that perspective.
There's an energy that's magnetic.
Yeah, yeah.
That pulled you towards each other.
Yeah. Well, we've been going for a while. We should probably close soon. Yes. What time do you like to close?
9:10.
9:10. Step on top.
Yeah. So, I really like that we got to just talk more, and that really carries the core of what I was here to say. And you know, the other slides you can pick up from some of my talks online, or actually, a lot of this talk is on the Science and Non-Duality Conference website. It's actually through my YouTube. And I'll be speaking there again this year. It's a great conference. How many of you have been to the Science and Non-Duality Conference?
Where is it?
It's in San Jose. It's fantastic. The people who put it on live locally. Mauricio and Zaya. They're fantastic people. And so I would recommend you go to that. And you can find on my YouTube channel through my website, skynelson.com, you can find a lot of other writings and videos. And I have papers and blog posts I've written lately. And I just encourage you to keep the conversation going with me. And I think I've said all I need to say.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for, on behalf of Many Rivers, I just want to point out that we do have, as Sky said, his CD over there, and next to it there's a donation bowl. We encourage you to contribute to that, which we share with him in order to further his work. Going to graduate school costs money, I can tell you that. And there are other things that a father has to pay for as well. So please do be generous. And we'll look forward to seeing you 1 week from tonight for silence. Lots of words about silence. Lots of words about silence. So thank you so much. Thank you all for coming tonight.
I have an email list on my website.